Welcome to the Rock Fight, where we speak our truth, slay sacred cows, and sometimes agree to disagree. This is an outdoor podcast that aims for the head. I'm Colin True, and today we're going deep on some of the latest headlines to come out of the footwear world with a footwear expert. Richard Kaczynski has been making footwear for over 20 years and is the founder of the Directive Collective, an agency that partners with brands to go from concept to production in the running shoe space. Richard has an intimate knowledge of both product and brand and has no problem offering his opinion on the direction a brand is taking when it comes to the shoes they make. Now, we've touched on several footwear-related headlines here on the Rock Fight recently, and I am excited to welcome Richard on the show to go through the current state of athletic footwear, but also to go deeper into stories like Lululemon's new line of shoes, the Deckers Anu Super Sneaker fiasco, as well as the Adidas single-use marathon shoe. Welcome back to the Rock Fight, where today we're talking shoes with footwear designer Richard Kaczynski. Welcome to the Rock Fight, Rock Fight, Rock Fight. All right, we are here with Richard Kaczynski. Welcome to the Rock Fight, man. Stoked to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Colin.
All right, so you're a footwear guy, so we need to know, what shoes are you wearing right now?
I'm not wearing any shoes.
You're not wearing any?
I have like 25 behind me that I have been wearing
them,
the past
week.
Yes,
kind of a personal brand fail though for you not to have a pair of shoes on. I feel like you're not allowed to wear flip flops or gear barefoot in your line of work. You should always have shoes on.
I don't know. I'm a shoe guy, but I don't wear shoes in the house. What can I say?
So I kind of want to start with the sort of the category itself, because when I was working at retail places like City Sports and Eastern Mountain Sports, and then I tech wrapped for some footwear brands, I always saw the footwear department, and I feel like this was validated from the folks I talked to in the shops and my coworkers. Like, the footwear department at a shop is sort of the epicenter of the shop. And I think that's true whether we're talking about a specialty retailer or even a Dick's. You know what I mean? Like, it's all sort of circles around the footwear section. And I always refer to, outdoor and athletic footwear as the show, right? You might make really cool pieces of apparel. You might make really cool gear. But in my experience, especially in that tech rep role, if I was putting a pair of shoes in somebody's hands, it was like being touched by the finger of God. Like, oh my God, you're giving me shoes? Like, it just was this incredible experience to be able to hook somebody up with a pair of shoes. And I just think it there might be categories that generate more revenue. But for some reason, I think shoes captured us in a way that other products don't. So as someone who's been designing, footwear for over 20 years, I mean, does that resonate with you? Do you have an explanation for why maybe I feel that way?
I think that's absolutely true. I think, shoes are personal and they're cultural. And I mean, put it this way, people line up for shoes. People don't line up to get socks, right?
They'll take them,
sure.
But it's not the same.
Yeah. I mean, I think, the thing with shoes is obviously it's, I think, holds a special place for people. And it doesn't matter if you're talking performance or sneakers and lifestyle, because it's that separation between yourself, the human, and the earth, for one. I mean, I guess you could say socks does that too. But I think that physically makes a difference. It's an intimate object, from that perspective. I think anything that kind of goes on your body has that, whether it's, glasses or jewelry or whatnot. But I think shoes are also special because you're also likely to have very few of them, in a sense. I mean,
right.
Obviously there's, sneakerheads and whatnot, but you may have 25 t-shirts. You're probably not going to have 25 pairs of shoes. I mean, not true for
you
me.
Do.
No, I do. Yeah. Sure.
We'll get into the sustainability part later.
But I think that's kind of what makes it special. And it is the sort of, also object. I think that's kind of also the big difference between, even gear, that is a physical thing, or apparel, is that shoes, the combination between sort of hard and soft and different materials, it kind of becomes something kind of more than just, okay, here's a really great cotton shirt and it's stitch and cut, where shoes has all these different components, different materials. There's some magic, I think, in there.
Yeah, and it's the one kind of thing we can wear in our body. I mean, you could obviously have a branded t-shirt, or maybe you're wearing something, especially if it's outerwear, that has a brand on it. But it's the one kind of billboard we wear that is sort of just always socially acceptable. Like, my kids, ever since I worked at Timberland and kind of become like a footwear guy from my time in retail, I can't help but look at shoes. And I haven't worked in footwear specifically in a long time, but it's just kind of stuck with me. I think when you become a shoe dog, it kind of becomes part of your DNA. And I remember I was in Europe with my family this summer, and we're walking around Rome, and I'm just pointing out the shoes that people were wearing to my kids. I'm like, see that? That's an American brand right there. That's interesting. That person looks like a local. They're wearing kind of a brand that we have. And they say, I'm not sure who that is. And my kids look at me like, Dad, are you just looking at everyone's shoes? And I'm like, no. I was immediately embarrassed by it. But it is this sort of way to kind of, you really can subtly signal to the world via a logo or even like the silhouette of the shoe about kind of who you are. I mean, I'm getting a little kind of woo-woo on this, but I kind of feel like that's true.
I think it's one of those things as well, and I'm not sure I can, you know, go into the psychology behind it, but that, you know, everyone has an opinion on. I mean, like, right. Whether you ask, you know, a young guy or, you know, my mom or grandmother, whatever, everyone will have an opinion, whether it's like, okay, this is not comfortable, what's going to work with my bunions, you know, what's cool, what are the kids wearing? Like, I don't think it's the same thing when it comes to, you know, apparel or comes to even most accessories. You know, some people are watch people, great. Other people don't care as long as it tells the time or, you know, right. Smart watch or whatnot. But I think shoes is kind of one of those things because of that, I guess, maybe blend of cultural aspects and function and performance and fit. I mean, it makes a big difference. Right. And then also just kind of that lifestyle, that this cultural signifier of, you know, whatever, social, economic or fashion or personal taste that makes it kind of unique for sure.
You know, definitely when I was a kid in the 80s, 90s, I feel like, and I could be wrong about this, you would have the data, you'd know better than I would, but it feels like the kind of popular sneaker styles or silhouettes were a little more diverse. Like it kind of, we had the Chucks and the Sambas were big for a while, and Sambas seem like they're back now. And then basketball shoes. And then there's obviously kind of the cross trainer boom that I don't even know. That's funny that cross trainers, I don't feel like that has come back in a meaningful way. And you figure with all like the kind of 80s and 90s nostalgia, cross trainers would be like, you know, Reebok should be having a moment here. But the it does feel to me that everyone today is kind of competing for just like running shoes, like running shoe scraps. Like what everyone has a pair of running shoes. It feels like a running shoe world that we're living in. I mean, is that an accurate assessment, or am I kind of, you know, pigeonholing that too much?
I mean, obviously as a runner and running shoe designer, I'm a little bit biased, but no, I think that's true. I think sort of running shoes today, I like to say, are sort of where basketball shoes were in the 90s. I mean, you know, back then it was, you know, sort of peak Jordans, you can say, and, you know, Reebok pumps and, you know, DMX and all that kind of stuff. And that's what was hot for sure. There was trainers and stuff. And my first pair of shoes I can remember was the Air Trainer from grade 7. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a thing. But I think, yeah, today, nowadays, that running performance has kind of taken over that. And obviously, I use performance here sort of very loosely, you know, because there's sort of, it's a pretty big spectrum. Yeah. But I think it is that kind of thing where, again, it's the combination between aesthetics, between you know, actual functional performance, and that sort of elevated kind of object style. I mean, running shoes are now more expensive in many cases than basketball shoes. And basketball shoes were the ones that were leading. You know, those were some of the first shoes that were over, you know, whatever it was, $150, $200, you know, back in the day. And, you know, now there's running shoes that are, you know, getting up there, right?
When did that flip? That's a really good point. I mean, less than 10 years ago when it was still mostly like the kind of Asics, Brooks, like, you know, Saucony world, it still felt like running shoes were in the $110, $130 range. Even trail runners at that point were kind of in that ballpark. And now it's like very routine that these things are over $150. I mean, especially in the trail running category. Was there a moment when that flipped? Are things just like, hey, that's just actually we're now charging what we should have been charging all along. Like, what can you pinpoint when that flipped?
I think it kind of goes back to, you know, the innovation and material side of things. I mean, I think that typically is the driver, you know, in running shoes in particular, and, you know, maybe in a larger picture in footwear in general. But I mean, I think it kind of goes through sort of generations and phases. I mean, from the, you know, old running shoes that were, you know, die cut and buff, you know, EVA and rubber, you know, those were, you know, whatever price, that was kind of before my time, to when things started changing to, you know, molded EVA or, you know, PU midsoles in the, you know, whatever, late 70s, 80s, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the New Balance shoes, for example, like, you know, their numbering system originally was based on price. So that $990 was $99, right?
Oh, no.
And that's why that was the top end shoe, because that $99 price point was, at the time, whenever that was, kind of crazy, right? So they had to kind of lean into it. And it was part of the whole story. It was like, this is top performance because you're getting, you know, whatever, you know, technology was sort of, you know, based in that. And I think that, you know, the generations of running shoes since have kind of followed that same sort of pattern. You know, first jump I would probably say is back in 2000, maybe it was 11 or 12 or something, with Adidas Boost. That was sort of the next generation of technology from molded EVA and all that stuff from the 90s, where it's, you know, TPU shanks and stuff, all this stuff is coming back in fashion now, but in a performance sense, to a new material that BASF developed, the Infinergy TPU. expanded TPU that had all this great performance and had this cool look, but it was also really expensive. It was like a very engineered polymer, and that made those Adidas Boost shoes, when they first came out, really expensive, you know, relative to whatever else was on the market.
For the record, I never liked the Boost shoes.
It's complicated, let's just say.
Did you work on that? Am I insulting you right now?
I had nothing to do with it. I think I've only ran in a pair of Boost once, like someone who was working for some PR agency gave them to me, but that could be a whole another episode just talking
about it. It felt like, you know, because like the Nike Air, it always felt like, I'm like, I don't think that's really doing anything, but it looks cool. And like the Boost was like that, like times 10. I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think that's doing anything for me, and it looks terrible.
I think what Boost, though, brought into the market, you know, not to get too much sidetracked on Boost, was, you know, again, that next generation, you know, engineered polymer material. It was a new material kind of used in footwear. PU had been used before, but this expanded, you know, TPU beads material had a initial feel on it that was very, very different. It was really soft. It was really springy. And that's, I think, a big part of why it became popular. You know, on paper, it also did work. It had that rebound, but also, yeah, had some drawbacks. It was kind of heavy and like, it looked kind of weird and whatnot, but that was that next generation. And then obviously now we're sort of past that. And we're now in this next generation where everybody and their mom is using PBA material, you know, PBAX or, you know, unbranded, not from Arkema, but that's also why things are jumping up. And now you have carbon fiber, and like, that's kind of where the point we're at now. So, I mean, you know, all those different price points that you talk about and all those kind of different generations and even sort of interest of shoes in terms of like the technology and the performance and sort of what is in there that's new, I think kind of comes back to that innovation and comes back to that, you know, performance development, really.
So how much is trend and aesthetic versus performance? Because I just wrote down while you were talking, like, and you kind of led right into it with all the headlines from an outsider's point of view seem to be right now, at least in the trade stuff. I'm not sure what's really making it to the consumer level, but is carbon plates on trail runners. Like, here's our new shoe with the carbon plate on it. And I know between modified Shanks, and even when I was at Timberland, we were making trail runner shoes in the early 2000s, and we're working a plate system into it and all those kinds of things. But now it feels like it's becoming like the story du jour of the category. Is that just trend? Is that kind of like, is it new technology? I mean, is there some, you know, proof in the pudding there, or is it just like, this is just the thing that's happening now?
I think it's a little bit of both, and I think it's a combination thing. And, you know, for one, I'm definitely not a biomechanist and I'm not a material scientist, but, you know, obviously I have a lot of both practical experience as a runner and as a running shoe designer in this. You know, for one, the carbon fiber plate idea is definitely not new. Like,
right.
Fila was using carbon fiber, you know, back in the 90s, I think it was, in some running shoes. And again, this whole idea of having a stiffer shoe and having more, you know, energy stored and energy returned, you know, is definitely an extension of everything you're talking about with those, you know, TPU shanks or, you know, different materials, stuff like that, that, you know, all those crazy 90 shoes that are coming back, or 2000 shoes that are coming back, are doing in fashion. But I think, you know, the again, kind of going back to what I was saying before, the innovation is, or the difference is, this next generation where it's the combination of these super foams, they call them, you know, these PBA foams or supercritical foams. That's sort of why they're called super foams. New foaming process, and that plus the carbon fiber plates is something that is actually new. And it is new from both a material perspective and an innovation perspective, and also from a performance perspective. I mean, these new foams that they have, you know, again, sort of that next generation past Boost, are super light and super bouncy and super responsive. But when you combine more of it, because more foam is more bouncy, they're also unstable. So when you sandwich that plate in there in the middle, that's when you get not only the benefits of the plate acting like, you know, not a spring per se, but, you know, as a kind of rebound or you know, a lever kind of effect, but also as a stabilizer, you know, sort of stabilizing that sandwich of foam. Because, you know, try and, you know, walk around on, you know, a marshmallow. It's not going to work out very good.
I had an early pair of Hokas. I know what that feels like, you know? I mean, actually, that's an interesting comp too, because there is, I mean, if you go back now and look at the 50 plus years of sort of the modern running shoe, especially, or even just athletic shoes, and you do see these like little peaks and valleys of technology, and it kind of always then seems to balance out to, well, you know, we've got an upper, a midsole, an outsole, and it's basic and it's foam. Maybe the foam improves those kinds of things, but at the end of the day, that seems like the tried and true method. And then you have these other sort of diversions into different technologies that some hit, maybe it carries forward, some they don't, you know, those kinds of things. Like, I mean, Hoke is a good example. We actually are reviewing this on our gear segment later. It will be this week when our episode comes out. And that's one where I, you know, when coming out of the kind of barefoot craze of the 2009-10 time frame, and, you know, even between, you know, Altra and Hoka and these brands, it kind of felt like, oh, that's cool that the category expanded to kind of create some new technologies. But I never in a million years would have said that Hoka is going to become a billion-dollar brand that I see on, like, moms and dads at the airport. They're like, they're truly, it's like they're in the mix now with, you know, Asics and Brooks at the airport when you look at people's feet, right? And like I said, I look at people's feet all the time. So I how do you even, can you even predict something like that happening? I mean, is that something that surprised you?
I mean, I think if one thing is true in footwear, but maybe most industries, it's this idea of a pendulum swinging. And I think that, you know, Hoka has been on the right side of that pendulum, you know, to some extent, you know, since it kind of came out and as that maximalist kind of concept, you know, coming at a time when, as you said, that, you know, the barefoot or the very minimal concept was out, which, you know, I did a lot of work in that space. And I do remember seeing, you know, Hoka the first time at some, you know, trade show, whatever trade show that was. And it was this, yeah, kind of holy shit kind of moment. Cause like, you know, what is this big beefy, like, you know,
the new shoes
thing
that the Spice Girls are wearing, you know, like,
yeah. And I mean, obviously, you know, that gets some kind of reaction, but obviously the you know, targeted performance for, you know, trail runners or going down a hill or kind of whatnot makes some sort of sense. But yeah, I mean, the, you know, overall expansion of that into lifestyle, I mean, I think it's sort of, yeah, one of those things I think people were writing probably business case studies for a long time about that.
Yeah, well, don't worry, Deckers. We have some criticism coming for you in a minute here. But good job on Hoka. I guess kind of last thing before we move into some, you know, footwear headlines. How are we feeling about On? Because On, to me, just as like a cynic and somebody who's, frankly, I've never even worn a pair of Ons, and I kind of, my running days are behind me because of some knee issues. But at the same time, I look at them and I'm like, that's just like the shoe that happened to hit. Like that's the trendy shoe that happened to hit. It's got they made something really interesting in the midsole that I don't really believe does that much. But how are we feeling about On and the On revolution that we've been experiencing the past few years?
Again, it's really complicated.
Is it complicated?
Well, it's complicated in terms of, I would say, my thoughts on the matter. I actually have a whole article I'm working on. It's in my sort of drafts at the moment.
Won't spoil that.
But yeah, well, it's not finished, so nothing to spoil yet. But I do, I mean, put it this way, I also do remember seeing the first time a pair of On shoes. And I was actually in a factory working on a minimal concept at the time over in China in 2009 or 10-ish, something like that. And we were working in the same factory that was making Ons, and you know, it was one of these, again, kind of like, whoa, what's that kind of moment? But yeah, I mean, I definitely agree, at least in terms of many of the iterations. Like, I don't think it does anything. I think, you know, it's interesting watching the evolution also of that sort of so-called technology of, you know, these air bubbles, which were actually originally all molded in rubber and then kind of became to be half rubber and then attached to a midsole. And then now there's kind of holes in a midsole and then kind of getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But obviously, again, it's that kind of combination between doing things differently and also being consistent at it. I think that for the most part has been their success. I mean, their shoes, even from the first ones, you know, looked very different aesthetically, not only the technology, but even sort of the upper design, you know, much more simplified design when everything was all, you know, crazy overlays and screen prints and, you know, bells and whistles and whatnot. And yeah, I think it's also kind of just a testament to the storytelling of it. I think they've done a very good job of that. Like, if they're telling you these are clouds or pillows or whatever they're called, they look like that. So yeah, your mom could understand that. Like, that kind of makes sense.
Honestly, the biggest hurdle is the name of the brand itself. I didn't know what they were called for probably the first year I knew they were around. I'm like, is it just On?
Well,
like,
that's it. People still don't know what they're called. Honestly, like, the number of times I get, like, you know, some uncle or some, like, you know, random person come up to me and be like, oh, have you tried these shoes? They're called like QC or something because the logo.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah, actually, I can't find it for the life of me, but I read an article once that they actually have bought all of, like, the Google keywords for all, like, the misspellings of the brand because nobody can spell it because the logo doesn't look like it spells On because it looks like like a U or a Q or an A or a C or something like that. And yeah, not to mention that trying to Google the word, like, On running, I mean, obviously, if you throw a lot of money at it, anything works. But, like, it's like naming your brand The.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I think the antithesis to Hoka, where I kind of look at that and go, wow, I can't believe that has had mass appeal. I think what On has done well is like the shoes have, you look at them, like I could see that becoming a popular shoe because they're just nice and clean looking and like very broadly speaking, a good looking running shoe. The technology almost doesn't matter, right? So between like the work they put in on the marketing side to kind of get it out there, and it's reasonably simple. And even the technology story is simple too. Like, oh, we put these bubbles in there. Like, okay, you know, I know what Nike Air is. That's probably close, right? No, it's not the same, but close enough, right? So I get it. I get why that hit. The Hoka one still kind of makes me scratch my head.
Yeah, I mean, I think both of them, though, kind of at least share those same challenges, though, at the same time of like, you know, it is easily understandable. And yeah, all the moms or the, you know, whatever people in line at Starbucks or at the airport or whatever are wearing them. But, you know, how does that also relate to the authenticity story of coming from performance or offering performance or you know, speaking to runners? I think that that's, you know, definitely a whole topic that, you know, again, aside from sort of what Wall Street or the industry says is something that is relevant to discuss because, you know, I mean, at what point does that performance brand become all lifestyle and then loses some of that performance, right? Like that's...
Well, but what's the figure? It's like 75 or 85% of running shoes sold are just never worn to go running in. I mean, it's almost always... You'd be silly to kind of think that we're only launching a performance brand. I mean, I wrote down Speedland. Is it Speedland or Speedland? However you pronounce it in our doc, because you know, $300+ running shoes. But I also kind of get it too as a runner. Like I'd be really curious. I'd be more interested in trying to run in those than I would be in a pair of Ons, right? And so I think that most people are probably designing for the masses, even if they think they're not, just based on the numbers.
For sure. But there's also, I mean, brands to kind of, you know, think about in terms of like, you know, Champion, I saw they just got, you know, another brand that got, you know, sort of bought, you know, this week by, I guess it was ABG or something like that. You know, they used to be, you know, again, pure performance and totally, all that. Yeah. And now it's like, you know, sweatshirts at Walmart and stuff like that, right? Like nobody, you know, thinks of them.
They're like, hey, we can make a lot more money doing this.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, obviously their business has changed and whether that's successful or not is a different story. But I know at some point, I don't think it's possible to have kind of your cake and eat it too. And I think that sport lifestyle and performance mix and balance is, you know, is tricky. It's not just like, okay, whatever sells, we're printing money. And there's lots of, you know, kind of cases of that. I mean, even, you know, bigger brands that obviously have that heritage and, you know, have the authenticity from coming from sport of, you know, how easily that can kind of go away. You know, another brand at ABG, Reebok, another perfect example, right?
Well, let's talk about some current like footwear stories. You know, there are two recent stories that resulted in you and I connecting and chatting, and there's kind of another one I want to get your weigh in on. And the first one though is Lululemon's, you know, new footwear line for men's. So Lulu recently announced that they're expanding their footwear line to include men's. You know, the shoes are, I guess they're running shoes or at least running adjacent. I think they're kind of positioning them as running shoes. You know, my take was less about the shoe itself and more about the marketing of the shoe. I know you've now had a chance to try the shoe. So what did you think as both, I guess, both a runner or design perspective? I think you can say that if you'd say they perform great, I'll believe you. I also feel like, I mean, this is a full kit play more than it is like a performance footwear play, I think, anyway. What'd you think?
I think there's a lot going on in this story. I mean, this is what they've launched now is their second generation of shoes. Their first one came out a year or two ago, and those were women's only. I did buy one that sort of converted to my size or close to my size. And that one was, I'm going to just say, unabashedly terrible. You know, it was like a Payless shoe, honestly. Just, you know, quality of build, design, materials, just basic EVA, rubber is heavy, huge drop, like... there's no redeeming qualities from my perspective. Their new generation, I have to say, is much improved. And from a product point of view, I was impressed just A, that they were able to kind of step it up. And I think it's a lot more, at least kind of contemporary in terms of, you know, what someone would expect at that price point. Definitely not cheap. You know, the larger story though, I think, is kind of the, as you say, sort of that marketing play and the whole idea of like, okay, this is like designed for women's and this is something new and innovative. And, you know, there's that whole thing, which you know, for one is, you know, may or may not be true in terms of how many foot scans they did or research or kind of whatever, but obviously they're not the first ones doing that. Like this is 100% not something new. I mean, I literally have a book here of like old ads from the, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s from all these different brands. It's a sneaker freaker kind of compendium thing. And there's tons of ads from whatever, Nike and New Balance and Reebok and stuff going back to, you know, early 80s that say the exact same thing, that, you know, here's our first women's shoe and whatever. So that's not new. And again, talk to, you know, any of your friends in the industry who work with lasts, people at Jones and Vining, and they'll tell you that, like, yeah, this is not a revolution. Like, tons of brands do.
Yeah, but then why do they keep marketing? Not to interrupt you, but it's just like, Adidas had a Terex hiking boot like a year ago, and they're like, hey, we're building on a women's last. I'm like, you don't need to say that anymore. That's not a marketing bullet point. If you weren't, that means that says to me that you weren't doing that before.
Well, I mean,
mind blowing to me.
It is a marketing bullet point because it works, and obviously, you know, we're talking about it, and other people are talking about it, and other people don't know that. Yeah, there was some shoe, or even whole brands like, you know, Ryka in the 80s that was doing only that, right?
Right. Oh my God, I forgot about that brand.
You know, Avia, another one. You know, so there definitely is a precedent there. Again, whether or not it's right or not is another question. I mean, I've also talked to, you know, people who are, you know, biomechanists, and you know, they've told me, more than one has told me that, you know, and again, this is not my domain, that, you know, there's actually more variation within a gender than across genders. So even within, you know, a women's gender, for sure, there are some, you know, broad speaking, you know, differences between men and women, you could say, just as you could say, you know, in general, men are taller or something than women.
Right.
But there's also, you know, wide and skinny kind of within a gender. So, you know, is that, you know, gendered fit necessarily the solution? Not always. It's not that simple. Right. But again, as a marketing point, for sure, there's something there. And again, people can see that, they understand that, and like, okay, that makes a difference. Yes, women's bodies are different than men. Women are not small men. Like, yeah, I get that. So that works. I mean, for me though, the more complicated thing is, or the confusing thing is, why are they doing that? And then at the same time saying, and hey, we also have a men's footwear collection. I just kind of like feel like it's shooting yourself in the foot. Like, you kind of can't have it both ways, right? You know, and it's the weird thing as well, too, in terms of also, you know, knowing their market and, you know, knowing their customer and kind of what are they trying to achieve and how is that customer different between men's and women's, but yet trying to like do the same product and it's almost the exact same, almost the same colors. You know, there's some minor differences in, you know, design language or whatnot, but it kind of seems like, you know, they're throwing a lot at the wall and I'm not sure what's sticking at this point.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, we had similar takeaways for different reasons, right? I think because it just, you know, the thing that made me bristle in some of the press materials about it was, you know, the phrase, you know, innovative and breakthrough and all these things about the shoe, which is not, that's a, I've said this ad nauseum probably on this podcast. I mean, I pick a brand in the outdoor and active space and show me like where they don't say those things. And it's just, as someone who works at a textile manufacturer, it's like, yeah, well, there's not a lot of innovation and breakthroughs happening, guys. You know, like, I think like the conversation we just had about, yeah, foams and plates, like, that's interesting. That's different. That's at least design innovation based off of new materials and things like that. But it's also, I wouldn't necessarily say that's a massive breakthrough. That's kind of just applying, you know, what we know in a better way. And so to say that, like, hey, Lululemon, you cracked the code on men's athletic footwear with this massive breakthrough, it's like, it's just an overstatement. I mean, and I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, hey, we took a look at our kit and be like, you know, I think men would like to have some Lulu shoes with their Lulu. We have enthusiasts that wear ABC pants and go out and run in our stuff, and they dig our shoes. I think that's a good enough reason for you to make footwear, you know. And I would imagine there's plenty of folks out there who will buy Lulu shoes because they're enthusiasts of your brand. You don't have to try and like sell me on like this big innovation breakthrough.
For sure. I mean, I think, you know, obviously Lulu has, you know, no, you know, they don't have the market, you know, cornered on hyperbole, as you say. Every brand kind of does that. But I think for sure that message does get confusing, and the connection of the message and the brand to the product when it's like, hey, this is something totally new, it's totally innovative. And, you know, it's not, like I said, this new collection, I would say, is relatively current in terms of, you know, materials and design and whatnot, but definitely it's not, I would say, I couldn't point to a single thing that's innovative or different or new. You know,
right.
The first collection was 10, 15 years behind. So yeah, they've caught up to date. That's
so
good.
I guess compared to their own collections, it's incredible.
For sure. But then also there's the whole aspect of, like you say, you know, what is this shoe for and who is it for? And if they're making this whole thing, and even online, I mean, someone was messaging about it like, oh, I don't know if this is really for running. And like literally on their website underneath the little card, you know, when it pops up, it says, you know, Blissfeel, whatever it's called, designed for running. It has those words. So I'm like, oh, okay, it's designed for running. But then, you know, if I'm trying it or I'm commenting on it or you know, judging it against other running shoes for running, and people are like, oh, well, it's not for running. It's just for running. Like, again, you can't have it kind of both ways, right?
You can't. Especially if the brand's selling you that, like, so what was your takeaway running in it?
I think it was a pretty decent shoe. I was definitely pleasantly surprised. I would say it felt comparable to like a Nike Pegasus or something, like a good, mid-range trainer, which I think for what they were kind of going for, makes sense. But then again, there's that whole kind of disconnect between what they're saying and what they're doing and kind of how they're marketing it, because they had this whole event, with the ultra runners running for 6 days in the desert and stuff like that. And, the runner who broke all those records, she wasn't actually wearing the shoes that looks like she was wearing, because she was wearing.
And this is
a
what they
one.
Say that was like, that was made for, right? Were for these folks, right?
It's made for them, but it's not made for them because A, it's not an ultra running shoe. Like, obviously, I don't know how many pairs these people went through. Probably not one pair.
Just the pair they wore at the finish line.
And even the one, like I said, that the shoe that was worn by Camille Heron that set all these records, it looks the same. But if you actually look at some of the close-ups, it's a different shoe that is listed on the World Athletics list that is probably coming out later. But it's a development shoe that probably is a higher stack shoe made for maybe marathons or something like that. Maybe for the Olympics. I don't know. I just think it kind of comes down at the end of the day to kind of setting the limits within your brand. And it's okay if not every brand is Nike or high performance or breaking records or running marathons or whatever. That's okay too. Like, again, most people are probably not running a marathon. Like, I think it's 1% of people run a marathon ever. So athleisure or fashion or lifestyle or comfort or whatever, all those things are fine. Even I mentioned this, whatever, I guess it was two or three years ago when Lululemon was going into the last Olympic cycle in Tokyo, and they had sponsored, I think, two out of the three Canadian marathon team. And none of them were obviously wearing Lululemon shoes because there at that point weren't any. There were none.
Right.
Right. So it's right. What's the point here? Because they're also not wearing Lululemon clothes because you have to wear the Olympic uniform and whatnot. And they're not wearing the shoes. So is it just some sort of like a connection by association or something? Like, what are you trying to achieve, I guess, at the end of the day, from both a brand and a product perspective? I think how does that alignment fit? To me, that's the interesting conversation.
So speaking of what's the point here, the next story is the Deckers Super Sneaker. This is, you and I definitely had some good interactions on LinkedIn on this one. This one actually hit me hard enough that I recorded an emergency reaction podcast about it because I was so blown away at how this turned out. For the audience listening, Deckers, who's the parent of Hoka, Teva, UGG, they've been teasing a new footwear brand slotted next to those brands. And kind of saying it was going to be this cool new sneaker brand that was, going to apply the learnings from their other footwear brands. And then when they released it, it was just a very basic looking sneaker, but that it was also branded as Anu, which was a footwear brand that I believe Deckers launched. If they didn't launch it, they acquired it in like the 2008, 9, 10 range and then shut it down in 2018 because it just never really got traction. It was a little bit more of a boot brand then, but they had some kind of, outdoorsy looking sneakers as well. I think I described it on my podcast as a permanent resident of like the REI bargain bin, just kind of like always on sale at REI kind of brand. So it just was shocking to see that like after kind of, not that it was been like the world was anticipating this, but you're calling something the super sneaker. And then when you release it, the product wasn't that impressive. I honestly thought it was an old picture of an Anu in the image that was released, like a 10-year-old Anu design. And then you're calling it this thing that you just had laying around, this defunct brand you just had laying around. So what were your thoughts on the Super Sneaker and new Anu line?
I think when it kind of comes to things like this, and I think it actually even applies to the Lululemon conversation as well, it's all about, brands trying to find new opportunities. And I think that that's, fine, and that's definitely part of business. But I think, whereas, for example, Lulu had an opportunity to do something really unique in footwear, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't go into footwear, because they have a lot of attributes, of course.
And a lot of upside for Lulu. I think there's still like a really high ceiling for where those shoes could go.
Oh, for sure. And that's the, I think, interesting thing is that, they have a good brand. They are known for a lot of good, qualities, whether it's, fit or material innovation or, comfort and, being a cool brand, like that's also a thing. And for sure, that can translate into footwear. I don't think it has in terms of their execution. I think the same thing, though, applies with this, Deckers Anu thing is like Deckers saw an opportunity for, I guess, a more, I don't want to say, upscale or like older version of Hoka because a lot of old people wear Hoka. But, let's say a more, not even workplace appropriate because no one's in a workplace anymore. But like, a less athletic version, you know, perhaps, you know, and I think that that's kind of where they went. But I just, like you said, I don't really see why it should be a new brand and B, why they should recycle some brand that honestly, I never even knew I knew existed in the first place. So I don't know if that's good or bad, but like, you know, even the press release saying that like, oh, well, we just didn't want to put that much, you know, time or resources into coming up with a new brand. We had this thing kind of left over. Like, okay, well, how much are you spending on everything else? Like, you know, like
Deckers, fire your publicist. who was allowing that press statement to go out? I mean, that was honestly the most shocking thing in that was really said. The president, literally, anybody listening to this, what Richard has said was literally what they said. They're like, you know, it's a lot of hard work to kind of create a brand. So we had this thing.
But I mean, that if that's the case, then, you know, the even easier solution would just be don't make a new brand. That's even cheaper, right? Just call it, you know, Hoka Plus or something. I mean, they had this Deckers Lab thing, which also is this weird, you know, space that nobody knows about. It's kind of a brand, but kind of not a brand. It's sort of like a mishmash of different stuff. Like, yeah. not saying it should be that, because I think that that's just a, you know, weird mess. But like, you know, it could just be, you know, Hoka Lab or something, or yeah. Hoka.
Well, think of the conversation we just had talking about like the rise of Hoka. Like, wow, that was amazing that emerged given what the product was at the time it came out. Even you even said like the investment they had to make and how they're like, you know, cultivating their brand through, you know, SEO and their website and things like that. It's really difficult to start a brand, like really, really hard. I mean, I guess it's not difficult to actually start a brand. It's difficult to make a brand successful, you know, and I'm sure we could sit here probably for another hour and I'm sure you could recount like dozens, if not hundreds of stories in your career of working with brands or products that went nowhere or good intentions, all these things. Nobody wants to do something to fail. But Hoka being this kind of juggernaut of the footwear space, you've earned a little latitude from your audience that if you said, hey, we're going to kind of create this sort of, to your point, like a little kind of side project branded Hoka, you know, it's like a little more for that. You know, you have an older audience. I mean, the original Hoka audience were that I knew and how I came to know the brand were older runners who found out that they could still run because the cushioning allowed them to continue to run. Those are the stories I heard the most when Hoka first came out. It's like, well, and to your point, it's a lot of moms and dads at the airports. This would probably go over great with the people who are already wearing Hoka. Anyway, the whole thing is just like feels like a masterclass of like how to not launch a brand.
I mean, I just look at it from the perspective of usually you make a new brand if you're trying to create something that is totally new and different, or you're trying to like escape something that your brand was like that you don't want to be associated with anymore. And I don't think honestly, like, you know, say what you will about the product, you know, I don't think there's anything bad in terms of connotation of Hoka's, right? I mean, it's not Skechers, you know, for example, right? Which is you know, a brand that probably should make a new brand, but you know, like with Hoka, it's not like that it already has all this kind of bad, you know, press or bad perception, or it's, you know, not in retail because it kind of has hit a certain ceiling. You know, they're selling at, you know, Saks and, you know, good stores like that. Right. They're selling in specialty. They're selling obviously direct to consumer. They're with, you know, the cool kids and whatnot with the tattoo running groups. So there is a lot of range there. And I think, you know, to make a better product that has a different vibe, you know, whether it's under even sort of a sub umbrella, like the Arc'teryx Valence kind of thing, or even Lululemon has Lululemon Lab or whatnot. I think that would be an easier path and just easier understandable in terms of like not trying to compete against yourself. And like, yeah, if you kind of had another pair of shoes and your wife was like, you know, can you wear the nice Hokas tonight? You know, if you're going out, there's your solution. There's your opportunity right there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens with the Deckers thing. It just kind of, from the launch point of view, it just seems like this is just going to end the same as Anu ended in 2018. Like, I just kind of wonder, where is this going to slot in when, you know, I can't picture a buyer sitting there going like, oh man, I can't wait to get my hands on that thing and try it out. Like, it just, especially the way it was presented by the president of the company. But the last story I want to ask you about, I talked this with one other person. We have an environmental fashion journalist, Sophie Benson. She came on the show and we talk about a lot of sustainability stories that come out of the active space. But so Adidas, do you say Adidas or do you say Adidas? Do you go full American or do you go traditional? Do you go back and forth?
I say Adidas. But I think that's with a lowercase a, though, I believe.
It is. I think I spelled it in our outline with an uppercase. I was probably wrong. But so they released a $500 running shoe last fall that's only designed to last for a single marathon. And this is an interesting story to me. One, I didn't know about it for a long time. And usually stories like this that tend to get a lot of hoopla. But I wanted to use this as a springboard into the sustainability conversation of nothing else. I definitely want to get your thoughts on the shoes. I'm sure you have some. But the, you know, footwear, there's so much sustainability talk, on, especially in apparel. But, you know, when, especially when it comes to sneakers, it just feels like they're largely these really short-term use disposable items. And no one's really even made a lot of progress. And I think there's been not enough progress made on the apparel side. I feel like there may be even less made on the footwear side. So I guess kind of two questions. One, what did you think of the single-use shoe? And then two, kind of like, what is your point of view on the kind of sustainability argument? Because it does feel like a single-use shoe is a big step back when you talk about a sustainability story for footwear.
I think, you know, first of all, I haven't tried the shoe. I've, you know, read lots of reviews and, you know, I did a couple of videos about it, but I haven't personally tried it. But I mean, I think when it kind of comes down to any product, especially performance product, and especially a product as complex as footwear, you always have to talk about the compromises. And that's what it kind of comes down to. So, you know, making a shoe that is top performance, you know, better energy return, you know, better, faster, lighter, whatever, is going to come with compromises. And I think that, you know, the single use aspect of this particular product is just another one of those compromises. So from my view, it's not, you know, a problem, and it's not unexpected. I mean, you know, tons of race shoes, if you look at them, are probably not that comfortable, you know, and there's a reason, because you're only going to wear them when you're racing, right?
Right.
I mean, look at, you know, high performance, even football boots, like soccer boots. You know, they're really tight and they're really not comfortable, and that's just how they fit. Or
it's like a climbing shoe in a way.
Yeah, or climbing shoes, or track spikes, or kind of anything like that. Like, you kind of give up some, you know, thing in column A to get something out of column B. And I think that, you know, that shoe is just taking that to the next level, and to me is totally logical. Again, it kind of comes, you know, back to what we talked about before, innovation on performance. They're using a different kind of foam, a different kind of molding process, a different kind of production process to be able to kind of make that material as light and as responsive as possible. But with that becomes durability challenges. But, right, you know, it's not really an issue from the intended function of that shoe, right? If your shoe is intended to run 26.2 miles to run a marathon, let's say, and it falls apart after that, well, who cares? The whole point was to run that race. And if it gets you a little bit faster, if you're an elite or trying to get a certain time, that's totally fine. You know, I think, though, at the same time, mixing in the sustainability conversation is kind of a red herring, because, you know, for one, they're not going to be selling that many of these $500 shoes, that there's going to be giant piles of them in landfills, right?
But 500 of them that they made is still a pretty big pile, you know? I know, when compared to the rest of the album, that's just a sad statement.
Yeah, but compared to like 500 million pairs of, I don't know, whatever, Air Force Ones or
oh, totally. But that's a problem too, right?
Right. Yeah. But I think that that's the whole thing, though. It's like, it's focusing on the wrong things. And I think that, again, you can have sustainable running shoes and you can have sustainable performance running shoes. There's some really interesting, you know, brands in that space. But again, it's different level of compromises. So I think, yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm more shocked about, you know, it was at the Adidas outlet recently, and then a giant pile of the Adidas Parley shoes made of recycled ocean waste that are going to go back into being ocean waste. You know, that to me is more of an issue in terms of, like, you know, a greenwashing or a sustainability story than a shoe that is not designed to be sustainable and, you know, is, you know, even just from a material standpoint, actually probably a lot less waste if it does end up in a landfill than a normal shoe, because it, you know, weighs, 140 grams or something like that.
Oh, I think you do a one-for-one comparison. I completely agree with you. It's just the idea of, it's a little bit of like a hubris of, like, we're going to make a single-use shoe. You get to wear this one time and then you just throw it away, right? And just sort of, can you put it under that lens? I agree. You do a one-for-one comparison, I'm sure there are much, you know, quote-unquote, dirtier shoes in the world than these. And my argument, I think, on that episode was, hey, why are you releasing to the public? Like, just take your 100 sponsored athletes, whoever, and make them these shoes. They'll probably be stoked about it. Like, you know, because to your point, like, the $500 single-use running shoe market, probably pretty small. But it just feels like on foot, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, just feels like on footwear, there's not as much of a conversation around how do we make these things better as there is even on the apparel side. And I think the apparel side is not doing nearly enough as well. But it does seem to be a constant conversation, and hang tags. And I mean, greenwashing is a big thing in apparel because people want to get the attention for it. But then we're all just comfortable with, like, yeah, but I got some running shoes and they'll last 300 miles and I'll throw them away and go buy another pair. Right. And it's just like, well, that should probably be addressed as well at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think, though, it is being addressed. And again, like I said, there's those, you know, Parley shoes, and you know, Nike has regrind, you know, whatever materials and stuff like that. But, you know, it's to me, more trouble when sort of the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. When these brands, whether it's Adidas or Nike or smaller brands, kind of are saying, "Hey, we have this, you know, environmental mission, and look at this shoe over here that's like, you know, made out of whatever bamboo, recycled from whatever, whatever." And then also on the other hand, they have this other shoe that is not clearly sustainable. But again, from a specific perspective, those are fine to kind of coexist because they're for different, you know, intended uses and functions,
right,
and they're designed to do what they're going to do. But I think it's more, from my view, a little disingenuous as a brand to kind of, you know, pretend, hey, we're all about this in this conversation, and then sort of change the tune, right? I think it's, there needs to be a more, I think, honest and transparent thing of saying, hey, listen, we're sustainable, but only to a point, because we also really care about performance in this case, or we care about fashion in this case. I mean, the most sustainable shoe is the one that you don't make. Right. And these companies are in the business of making shoes. Right. So,
my whole biggest beef with any of these folks is just the wanting it both ways. Right. Cause you get like, you go to any of these brands and they've got 62 pages of like, we are the green company and we make these things and we make the world better by making products. And then, you know, it's not true. I'd rather them say, hey, listen, we're making the best shoes we can, and we're going to do whatever we can do that, cause that's how we make our money. I'd at least appreciate the honesty. And that's good to hear that there are some programs out there, and it's probably the same as apparel, where it's like, it's not as, we're not as far along with it as we should be.
You know, I just want to say, like, you know, to start with, making any kind of shoe, you know, of like reasonable quality and design, whatever, is really hard. The more of those things that you pile on top is like, just becomes harder and harder, like, in a way, exponentially. So, I mean, even when I get brands coming to me and like, you know, startups, and like, oh, we want to make a shoe that's like super high performance and it's sustainable and it's made in the USA and it's low price point and it's this. I'm like, okay, well, maybe pick one. Maybe
pick the one that you really want, and we'll see about the rest.
Yeah. Right. So, I think, you know, obviously, when, you know, these brands, like you say, are kind of like, you know, want it all and kind of want to do everything, I think that is kind of the tricky conversation that kind of needs to be more light shed on, in terms of like, these things can coexist, and there's obviously a different consumer for the person, you know, that wants to, you know, take that half a second off their marathon time and buy these $500 pairs of shoes, versus the person that wants a pair of shoes to last, you know, 800 miles or, you know, whatever it may be. And, you know, the value judgments that we add on to whether, you know, one is right or one is wrong, that's a different story, right? I mean, there's the facts of like, is it sustainable, or is it going to last, or is it fast, or whatever. Those are facts, you know, in a way, and whether it's good or bad, that's just another layer of perception, I think.
Well, right on, man. We can wrap it up there. Anything that anything you want to promote? What are you working on? Anything you can tip? Any exciting things coming out of the shop?
I mean, again, as I said, as a runner and running shoe designer, I'm always, you know, in that niche and sort of looking at kind of what's coming next. I've got a few exciting projects, you know, some super shoes that are back to our story.
Super shoes
probably coming out, you know, later this year, and some that are coming out, you know, spring 2025. 26. You know, always on the lookout for like startups, brands in the space. We talked a little bit about that, but I mean, for me, that whole idea of identifying opportunities and doing things differently, you know, challenging that kind of status quo is really exciting, and it's not for everyone, but when it works, it's pretty cool. But no, I mean, you can hit me up anytime at Directive Collective. That's me. And yeah, happy to talk shoes anytime. I can do this for hours.
Man, thank you for coming on. I hope to have you on again soon, man. This has been really fun.
It's great. Thanks a lot for your time.
All right. Good to see you. All right. That's the pod for today. But before you move on, you know what would be great? If you followed the show wherever you're listening, you gave the show a 5-star rating wherever you're listening, and also left us a comment like, my God, this episode of The Rock Fight changed the course of my life. Would you please do that for me? I mean, I'm just sitting over here cranking out 4 episodes a week for you. It's not a lot to ask, is it? Thanks, pal. The Rock Fight is a production of Rock Fight LLC. I'm Colin True. Thanks for listening, and here to take us out, he swears this is the last time, and he swears this is his last try, it's Krista Makes with the Rock Fight fight song. We'll see you next time, Rock Fighters. Rock Fight!